Hi, this is the Dark Tangent. And the speeches you're about to listen to were recorded at DEF CON 6, which was held in July 31st to August 2nd, 1998, at the Plaza Hotel and Casino in Old Downtown Las Vegas. These speeches are copyright, non-commercial use, educational uses only. If you'd like to use them for any other purpose, please contact DEF CON at www.defcon.org or email to dtangent. That's D-T-A-N-G-E-N-T at defcon.org. Now, some of the speeches were lost, so you're getting what we've got recorded. Now sit back and relax, and here comes some knowledge to your head.
I'm Art Moy. I'm just hosting the panel. You help me inspire. I am E. Joe B., and I would like to thank our previous guest that was here helping us out. We are waiting for Mudge. No one knows where he is. Would you like to come down or something? Come down. Okay, he's taking a shower. This is Securing Distributed Systems, and we're going to answer all the questions that you wish you could have asked early in the class. Okay. So if you want to ask about his past relationships. Oh, the panel, on the panel, from this side, Jericho.
Jericho.
Okay, we have Jericho on this side. Gary? Gail? He's Ralph? Alhambra? Howdy?
Mudge.
Okay.
Hit that man up there.
You didn't ask the question. I am Ijobi. I thought I said that. Okay. Yeah, I am Ijobi. Joby. You can call me. Any questions? No questions. All right, let's try with the topic, intrusion detection system. Who are you again? You can wait outside. Name two network intrusion detection systems that reassemble fragments. Anyway. Could everyone hear much?
No.
No? Okay. We're going to give the mics to people who have the questions. Guy in the back.
What's your opinion of the SPF 200 firewall? What?
your opinion of the STS 200 firewall.
Here comes a half hour rant. The SPF 200 is Sun Microsystems' second iteration of their sunscreen product, which is a stateful filter. And stateful filters are really quite interesting. I don't know how many people are familiar with stateful packet filters. Firewall One has some statefulness built into it. Sunscreen has statefulness built into it. Darren Reed's package, which is free, available on coombs.anu.edu.au, called IP Fill Fucking Rock, as Hobbit just said. No problem, son. Stateful filters, okay, Cisco routers and access splits used in them are stateless. What that means is each individual packet coming in, please tell me that's something I'm alcoholic. Excuse us, we'll finish this. Cisco routers are an example of a stateless filter. I'm just giving a little bit of background. Maybe I don't need to give background on what stateful and stateless packet filters are. How many people are familiar with what a stateful filter is? Okay, I'm assuming by the that's about half, so I'm going to do a little tie right here. Ciscos are stateless. Each individual packet coming in is looked at on its own merit. That knows nothing about the previous packet that it hit, that knows nothing about the packet that's coming in after it. When you see something that says established, that's not really keeping state for a session, that's just looking and saying, you don't have the SYN flag set only. Anything else, SYN ACK, ACK SYN, PUSH URGE, whatever, RESET, that's fine, you can go in. This is the notion of established inside of Cisco. So it's still stateless. What you'll have to have in a sunscreen or IP fill is upon watching a packet going out, it builds a state table inside saying, I just watched a TCP packet going from, let's say, port 10,000 to port 80. I'm expecting a packet coming back, and it had a SYN flag order, I'm expecting a packet coming back from port 80 to port 10,000. So I've built a state. If I get other packets that come in, or if I get packets that have the wrong flag that I'm expecting for the state, because I'm expecting the next packet, I drop it. I really like the sunscreen SPF 200. It's got some serious problems in it. I'd say turn off the certificate discovery for sure. But other than that, I think their biggest problem is that they overcharged for it. They didn't market it, and that they're pushing a competitor instead of it with what the hell is it? Firewall One. Am I much of a Cisco fix? I don't consider that anything to do with security, sorry. Yeah. Oh, okay, Tom. We'll give you a chance to redeem yourself. Okay. What do I think is more secure, proxy firewalls or stateful firewalls? You will notice during that entire little rant right there that at no point did I call the sunscreen a firewall, that I called them stateful filters. I'm cheating. How about a combination of both, keeping in mind that a firewall is not necessarily one box? Does that work?
No, actually it doesn't.
It's not secure. This is why I hate VPNs. This is why VPNs don't work also. It's like, you can't extend trust to outside your security perimeter. Period. Done. Disconnect from the net. What, that's what they do with classified stuff? Yeah, take those sheets for me. Bah! Yeah, there are definitely better ways of doing them. The comment was that Firewall One has some recommendations on how to do something a little bit more appropriate with their product. And there are more secure ways of setting these things up, and there are less secure ways of setting them up. Tom is looking for the ideal silver bullet answer right here because he knows there isn't one. Dan wants to make you look like a fool, but he's doing a good job.
Okay, let's assume that you have information on the inside of your organization you want someone on the outside of your organization to get to. How would you present it to them?
It's all a trade-off. How much risk are you opening up? If you have to get the information out or else your company goes under, you can't filter yourself and be safe about it. You know, you have to let it out. If somebody says, my company will fail if I don't let people directly count it in from all over the internet, I might have to do it. I can take steps for it, but you weigh the risks. If the cost, you know, cost to risk ratio. Okay, I'm going to hand back to the moderator here, so I'm hogging everything.
I think I'm going to stand up and walk around from people. Walk around to people in the panel from here on. Any other questions? Guy in purple.
What are your opinions on type enforcement?
What are your opinions on type enforcement for this question? Any comments?
No, I'm sorry.
Well, you should answer this one. Come on. No? No problem. Did I touch upon some super secret Uber project or something? Oh God, I probably did. You tell me. Type enforcement. Sidewinder, there were a couple of other systems that did it. I think Multics actually had some notion of type enforcement. It's very difficult to do correctly. It's a really neat and novel idea where everything is completely compartmentalized and relatively independent of each other. So if you quote unquote pop root in one area, you don't get root in the other areas. I think it's a good idea. I don't think people have really done it correctly yet. Or if they have done it correctly, it's too difficult for people to actually set up and run properly. And if you make it difficult or tough to use in a secure fashion, it obviously won't be used in a secure fashion.
Okay. Yeah, you.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of testing, is there any system that if I send in two packets, the first one, the packet is identical, but it's got a bad checksum, the second packet that comes in has the correct checksum, is there any intrusion detection system that's going to discard the first packet and not ignore the second one?
I guess you better sit up here. I have a seat for you right here. And this is Tom, I'll assume.
You assume correctly.
Hi, I'm Tom. I'm part of the SNI drinking team. Nice to meet you all. The question was, winner of the lost ECIP drinking game. The question was, is there an intrusion detection system that when it's presented with a packet that is identical to another packet, except for the fact that the first one that's the bad checksum, will discard the packet, right? And the reason why he asked that question is that in network intrusion detection systems, you can inject packets with bad checksums and fatally confuse the IDS, and make it not be able to know what the hell is going on in a network connection, and thereby launch all of your attacks without being detected. This goes for most intrusion detection systems. So you want to know which ones? Well, let me give you a hint. RealScare isn't one of them, right? RealScare doesn't check fragments. Since ISS is our competitor, I think I'll just stick to saying real secure stuff. But NFR doesn't. NFR is pretty cool. It checks checksums. You're right there. Did everyone hear the question?
No.
Repeat the question.
Do you think that it will be feasible, either now or in the near future, to design a scalable distributed host-based proof of detection instead of a network-based proof of detection system like what we're using right now?
Who? Tom. Yes. No. You're wrong. I'm right. You cannot scale like this. I am too. Tom and I go at it on this one to some extent. Tom believes that the only place to actually do correct intrusion detection is at the end host. You have other places to do it? Oh, he has other places to do it also, but he can't tell it to us. So, in other words, they're completely useless. Because
we can't know until he decides to sell them for millions and millions of dollars, obviously. There's some good points, and I'll let him talk about why it's really good to put it on the EndNode host, and I will proffer up that I might not know exactly where it goes. I got the feeling it's somewhere at either a switch layer or even some of the routers, but with the switches becoming more powerful. The end nodes are just completely unscalable. Having gone into corporations that have 300,000 plus machines, if I need to change something on these end nodes or even get them all up to the same rev, it's absolutely impossible. Even if everybody at these end nodes was extremely technically competent, which no company in the world has 300,000 extremely technically competent people working for them. But let alone, 300 technically competent people working for them, it seems. Jeremy has something. All right.
My opinion basically stems from the fact that most of the portions of intrusion actually occur on the host and not on the network, in which case doing it on a switch or doing it at the router level, you're really losing a lot of the data that's available in the analysis. So some combination of the two seems to be the only ideal solution. I think the word that you use that's most difficult for anyone to say yes or no on is the scalable portion. And it's very hard to scale this kind of intrusion detection system because there's so much information, and how do you manage it? You can't do it centrally because then you have a single point of failure. So you have to do distributed management. How do you do that effectively? And I don't think anybody's answered that question right now. Lots of research in that area, and lots of people, I think, trying to do something along those lines, and probably not succeeding.
I think Nate Watson has a question. I'm going to take over.
Okay.
Nate, ask your question. Okay, but after anyway, you're Nate Watson. They're mandatory. And if they're not enabled, the checksum has to be a specific value. You can't send an arbitrary UDP packet and have it have an arbitrary value in the checksum and have that not be a checksum. So your point isn't valid. Sit down, Nate. You've lost. Okay, let me restate the question because it was a long question. He's saying that checksums aren't always checked by the host, so if the IDS checks the checksums, well, it's like a tongue twister. If the IDS is verifying the checksums, okay, and the end system isn't, then the IDS is discarding packets that the end system isn't looking at, or is looking at, as the case may be. And it's all this big jumbly mess about what's doing checksums and what is. So his point is that you should always assume that a packet that has data is valid, and you should check it, okay? And that's an exponential problem, right? You can't just, you have multiple parallel streams at that point. If I insert a packet in a TCP stream that has a bad checksum and the one that doesn't, and play all sorts of different games there, I can create hundreds of different TCP streams, all of which you have analyzed, you lose, you can't do it, it's infeasible. Don't even think about it. Don't joke, Nate, author of, I'm not going to say it.
Okay, you right there? His question was, what routers are supporting, like, doing IPsec routing. Was that basically your question? Okay. Yeah, if you're looking for, like, an operating system that would support IPsec routing by default, OpenBSD comes with it out of the box, so you should really pick that up and take a look at it. OpenBSD, you can practically do anything with it. Dre here?
Yes. In the future, we're moving more and more to switch networks and even ATM or things pretty much point to point. What would be your solution for finding an intrusion detection system in a more that doesn't work very well. But finding a place to find these choke points or monitor ports or whatever to really be able to deal with the technology.
In the future, when everything's really fast and switched, and you can't just stick a sniffer on the wire because everything's switched, you don't see all the traffic, and much as, and you're doing come-through routing, can't do it otherwise, according to Jeremy. How do you build an intrusion detection system, and what technology do you use, and like how do monitor ports work, or how is that going to scale? I don't know the answer. I was just summarizing the question. So,
if we knew the answer to that, we wouldn't be sitting here talking to you. Unfortunately, we'd be probably out basking in the Bahamas and driving around in our nice Ferraris or BMW M3s or something like that. I don't know. It's a terrifying thought. The more we go down to not having any centralized point where the data goes through, the more difficult it ends up being, and the more unscalable, because you push it out closer to the end nodes each time, and it goes back to this scalability problem. That's where I see it.
But I mean, it doesn't really matter, because in case everyone in this room doesn't know, sniffing doesn't work, right? We already showed that sniffing doesn't work. So it doesn't really matter if you have a monitor port anyway, because the analysis that you're doing is flawed anyway, so you shouldn't bother. You should just put it all on the end node. Everything should be on the operating system, right?
Or acknowledge that the network portion is just one portion of an intrusion detection system and use that as one sensor in a greater, larger system.
I guess another part of that, with things moving directly in the HD5 or things like that, what is your feeling about ATM in general with removing some of the
Of course. What do we think of ATM? that's kind of a broad topic. If you look at I'm assuming that you're talking about current strict raw ATM and not the classical IP over ATM, which had a whole bunch of problems, and there was actually a really nice paper published at, I believe it was last year's Unix Security Conference. Flaws of classic IP over ATM. If you didn't read about it in your conference proceedings, go check it out. It's really good. So regular ATMs, and I can see how your equation is with the switches, because you're essentially setting up these tunnels and virtual pipes back and forth. I think it looks pretty good. I am a bit concerned about the actual hardware implementations and how they're addressable. More so than I am the attacks on ATMs right now. If you go look at, I believe Cabletron bought a couple companies that, they bought the big ATM company, I can't remember who it was, or not big, but the main one, and some of the other vendors, the weak part, the easiest weak point seems to be the actual boxes and addressing them and how weak they are via SNMP and how they're using their default passwords. The same as their SNMP community name, that's your telnet login, how they have back doors built in to the telnet stuff. They need to get that stuff taken care of before I even get the chance to really dive in and say, is ATM a real virtual pipe or not?
All right, we want to change the subject from intrusion detection to something else. So if anyone has a question on anything else in the back.
Anyone?
Okay, basically the question was, much like IDS in source code analysis looking for problems, you're never going to find everything. It's too difficult. There's too much. You reach critical mass and you self-destruct. Is that right? Okay. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And for all the flaws in some of the IDS tools out there, I'll keep price out of it. Let's imagine all these IDS tools were just given away for free. You could pick out the worst one, and I still say it's got some merit to it in certain areas. It's a notion of this industry is rattling itself forever, arguing over what the silver bullet fix is that'll clean everything up, and there isn't one. And I can say due diligence and all these other wonderful phrases, but that doesn't even come into it. It's fish or cut bait, and everybody wants to keep cutting bait, and some people are going fishing now. And things like Flint and things like for source code analysis, things like Real Secure and NFR for intrusion detection systems, they might get it wrong, but they're fishing. You know, they said, all right, we've got something. And I think that's a step in the right direction. I think you can't ensure, not in C at least, you can't ensure security coding in all possible examples. There's always going to be something new.
Jeremy, would you like to tell the audience what the hoping problem is?
No.
Static source code analysis doesn't work either. Okay, let's move on.
Guy in the white shirt. Okay, let's go down the line.
Sure, just some plug the Ethernet too.
Can front page be securely installed, or is front page secure? It's a Microsoft question, so. Does anyone have an opinion on NT? maybe we can wrap this up. No?
The answer is no.
Take out the Ethernet, put it in the locker room.
Good, okay. Next question.
Front page was designed to be convenient and easy to use for end users and not to be secure. And anytime you design a product to be easy and don't count security or don't factor in security during its design, it's inherently going to be insecure and almost impossible to retrofit with security.
Do you have a question? Why wasn't the NT box hacked? No one got around to it. It wasn't interesting enough, I guess. Okay, it wasn't upload enough to be hacked. You have a question?
The question is, kind of lack there, but it's pretty long. consider putting all of the things that we requested,
yes, his question is pretty long. Basically, what he said was, the more services you add, does it get more secure? Insecure? Was that what he said?
Nate, is this your question basically is something to the effect of, as you spread out intrusion detection into both host-based, network-based, and firewall-based systems, as you add more components, you increase the complexity of the systems and introduce more points of potential failure? Is that your question?
I don't propose a single component solution for intrusion detection, even though this is off topic, I do propose that the sniffer-based network intrusion detection component doesn't work very well. So we should find other components besides that component to use, right? So one component I know right now I don't know that has flaws right now is host-based intrusion detection, or firewall-based intrusion detection for the things that firewall-based IDS is good for. But the point is, we need to find better components than network intrusion detection because it's broken.
Okay, couple people here want to get off the IDS topic, so we'll give a couple pointers. The paper that the guys did at SNI, now NAI, where's that available?
If you got a pen, I'll give you a count of three, then, start writing. It's a good paper, you should read it. 63 pages of pure fun. I highly recommend it. The address is http://www.secnet.com/ides. That's it. Have fun.
And then the other places, there are companies out there, just so it's not slanted entirely for that paper. NFR is at www.nfr.com, and that either one of them works. There's Real Secure, which is over at ISS.net. And AbeerNet has SessionWall. I have no clue what the memco.com. And Vern Paxton, do you remember where that was located, though?
This is a longer one, though, so. And it's a really, really good paper on how to build an intrusion detection system.
FTP.ee
for electrical engineering. lbl.gov/nrg-papers. That's it. It's one of the first papers then.
So with those little golden nuggets, let's take it off of IDS before the holy wars really erupt.
You.
Right there.
There are no NT people in this panel. What was your question? Is the NT50 any better or worse than NT4037?
God, what were the AV people in this place thinking?
I haven't looked into it. It sounds awful. I heard a rumor just this weekend that they've dumped that and they're going with something else akin to Novell now. I don't know this. I haven't looked. Yeah, it was always like Novell unfold. I don't know. I mean, nobody's pirated me a sufficient number of Microsoft products such that I can research it, because I'm not going to go out and buy the stuff.
You already did? Repeat your question.
Distributed systems such as CORBA and or DCOM, are they secure, or is there anything, any comments related to security in them? DCOM, the distributed COM object, let's see. This was hilarious. Do you remember when Windows, when LogStack came out and we were basically taking advantage of the fact that the landman hash was extremely weak, so by cracking that, since they sent the NT hash next to it, you basically iterate from that point on. You go after the weakest link, and of course the lowest common denominator is where you want to go for it. And they provided a very low common denominator, making it very easy as opposed to 500,000 years to crack it. It turns out you can do it in about 23 hours on, you know, 166 megahertz Pentium, whatever. They said, okay, here's the fix for it, the LM fix, which is the landman fix, which would source the landman password out of the communications for the network authentication between the NT boxes. And this is great. If you run nothing but NT and this fix, you are secure because you are doing nothing but the NT hash, no more landman hash. Well, they didn't realize that this breaks DCOM on NT. Because DCOM relies on the old Windows 95 hash just going back and forth between NT boxes. Ooh, interesting, huh? So the landman hotfix was yanked from the site very silently when they finally did regression testing and realized we're fucked because all of these NT boxes rely upon the Windows 95-ish type hash. They're always saying, you know, it's insecure. So their complete argument for months saying, if you want security, run nothing but NT, completely fell apart. That's my DCOM story. Now, we saw a talk from Paul Leach on NTLM++, which was rather ironical, as they say, because they talk about secure DCOM coming in NT5. Well, DCOM was always supposed to be secure there, and they didn't bother to talk about the landman hash problem. But they did point out that even in their regression testing for the new NTLM hashing, they had the opportunity, since there's two passwords, the landman hash and the NT hash, of replacing one of them with a more secure one. Landman hash being weaker, NT hash being stronger, this new one being much stronger than all of them. So you'll still have a lowest common denominator. Which one were they able to put it in place of? They had to keep landman. They couldn't get rid of the super weak one. And this is because of the DCOM problems and everything else that still relies upon it. So security in those things? Maybe DCOM itself is fine, but the authentication mechanisms around it are completely riddled. I don't know. I haven't looked in the CORBA. Well, I don't want to talk about single sign-on. I'm going to like seize on a single part of your question, which involves radius. I'm just going to use this as a, you know, I don't know, stool here to soapbox to explain why radius sucks. Radius is the worst protocol ever invented. You should never, ever, ever use it. Okay? No, radius is quite possibly worse than FTP. Radius contends with SNMP for the worst protocol ever developed. Okay? Radius has no direct message authentication. It has a side effect of the password authentication, so you can't look at a radius packet and tell if it's valid. Most of them can be spoofed, and it takes a lot of processing before you can tell. Okay, not only that, though, the greatest part about radius is that it uses 8-bit selectors. Okay, this is a protocol developed in the 1990s. Okay, radius is a protocol where you have a whole bunch of like attributes stored in a packet about like a user, like their name, their IP address, where they're coming from, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Right? Well, they use 8-bit selectors for that. So there's only 256 possible attributes ever, ever, ever. We can never go beyond that, right? And the maximum data width is also 8 bits.
So we can only store 256 bytes of data per attribute. Yeah, go public key now. Yeah, this is really going to work. We can. It's a terrible protocol, so don't ever use it. But I don't know anything about TACX, so I'll hand that off to somebody else.
But you should talk about Kerberos.
Well, Kerberos, of course, is big and ugly, and MIT and a few other places are the only people that actually can actually get it running right in a large infrastructure. They've done a fairly good job. There's still a lot of bugs to work out. Kerb 5 is you know, pretty much there. It's even bigger and uglier. It's kind of cool, though. When it works right, it works pretty well. It definitely gives you single sign-on for any other, in an environment where you have everything understanding Kerberos. They're even starting to put it in Cisco routers so you can have Kerberos authenticated telnet in. The encryption is still not quite there, but they're working on it. They know that there are problems. So if you're willing to dive into that swamp, you'll probably do okay with it.
Any more authentication questions? Secure ID.
Who's got a secure ID card that they're willing to trash right now? We'll show you how to rip this thing apart right now. Will you? Oh man, what can I get away with saying here? Secure ID. Secure ID was really nice on telephone lines. Secure ID was a really good idea for one-time passwords in a non-promiscuous environment. Guess what? The internet is a promiscuous environment. Secure ID also uses long-term shared desk secrets. And now we know. If you haven't gotten the book Cracking Desk by O'Reilly, get it. It rocks. It was just released. The EFF built the nice desk cracker that does a full key space search in under 3 days. And they give you the entire plans on how to build one yourself. And the cost is, although not the cost that an individual is going to do, any small groups will be able to do it. The loss is actually building one right now with out of junk parts. So we're going to try and actually implement it for free as opposed to the $50,000 that they actually assume will. It would cost to buy one, which $50,000, by the way, is $10,000 less than a sunscreen. But the secure ID card, let's talk about these for a little bit. Completely predictable. The algorithm inside has been hacked. It is known in the industry that these things are flawed. It is known that they are predictable. It is known that XOR is not a strong encryption mechanism. The cards can be cloned. The cards are nowhere near tamper-proof. The crystal on the card is directly also accessible from the front without ever taking it apart. For those of you who don't catch the meaning of that one, these cards are time-based. Crystals control timing of the card. You can disconnect it, hook it up to a VCO for reverse engineering, so voltage control oscillator. You can single step through the thing. The programming leads are available directly on the card without taking it out. You can steal the secret key that way. You can replace it with your own. You can clone it and give it back to somebody else. If you put it inside of an encrypted sleeve so that you're no longer in a promiscuous environment, for instance, SSH, so you secure ID inside of SSH to some machine, guess what? That machine, you have to realize exactly what these things are doing and how they work. And this will bite you on the ass if you don't. I SSH from Lost to Tom's box, you know, because yes, I do. You just don't know it. You must not have a good idea. So I SSH from Lost box over to Tom's box, and I'm using secure ID inside of it because I'm thinking this is great. I'm entirely in an encrypted tunnel. Nobody can see my secure ID card. Well, what his box has to do is back end that out to the 8 server, which is the master one, which goes over a different channel at some high UDP port on the back end. This is where the shared desk secrets are done. Or if you know what's actually going from the system to the other system, you can spoof and authenticate yourself. So I SSH in, he's got a secure ID, and then I spoof the packet from the 8 server coming back to him saying, yeah, that's much, give him bin SH. You know, there's a whole bunch of problems. There are ways to do it more securely, and there are ways to do it less securely. There was a paper over at SecNet, which is on vulnerabilities of Secure ID, which is from a little while ago, and it's a little dated, and it doesn't talk so much about the hardware stuff, but it goes into a lot of depth on some really obvious protocol problems and network problems and how to attack it and how to defeat it. Some of them a little more esoteric than others, but definitely some of them seem to work. I think that Security Dynamics is doing a disservice by not going to RSA, who they own now, and really revamping this thing. I understand it's like a bar of fishhook because it deployed it, and it's a hardware token. And of course, the analogy with a bar of fishhook is it hurts like hell going in, but it's going to hurt a hell of a lot worse taking it out. Yeah, we all thought they bought RSA because they needed some real crypto, but we haven't seen anything with it. Yeah, the cars are relatively expensive. I mean, in large scale deployed systems, you know, it's very painful to try and ramp back down. But I beseech Security Dynamics to actually come forward and really make a concerted effort to improve the security and improve the cards. I think they can do it. They've got the talent.
I read the paper from SecNet, and it's pretty good, so you guys should check that out. You're right there? You're right there? What'd you say? What's your opinion on SSH something? Tom?
What was the last point?
The question was, what do we think of SSH and what is its future? Jericho.
Basically, it's a good start. A lot of people fail to see some problems with it and neglect host security, so they trust all these SSH events that are easily backdoored and all encryption is basically lost in it. Until SSH or more host security is around, the protocol is basically worthless. It's great for the casual kid that's trying to sneak it up.
Okay, my quick opinion about SSH is that if you don't know what the SSH user file service is, you don't know enough about SSH to be deploying it. How many of you have read the code? How many of you have counted how many lines are in the code?
The question really is, how many of you have understood the SSH code? They've got some extensive, complicated crypto and large number libraries there.
That's not fair. The question was,
okay.
No, I just want to go at it with somebody. I'm waking up, I'm hungover and everything. The actual question, so we'll get you on semantics here, is what do you think of the SSH protocol? The actual SSH implementation that Tato did over in Finland, Netherlands, whatever, it's really big. It includes the kitchen sink, everything under the sun. It's really gnarly and messy, and while as I trust it somewhat, I don't trust it that much. The protocol, there's an RFC for the SSH protocol. It's not tremendously difficult to implement. You can implement a much tighter, smaller, more easily managed executable to use this. I think the protocol isn't that bad. I'm scared about the notion that they're going to be trying to do more with tunneling mechanisms in the clients. This is just a bad idea from a security standpoint to be able to tunnel everything under the sun. But I like the protocol.
I would say one of the major deficiencies of the current SSH protocol is the inability to effectively do challenge response. There's no way for the server to send back a challenge to the client which can then respond to it, as far as I know. Unless it's been hacked or someone's gone and actually extensively reworked the SSH source. But are there if that's going to allow the server to send
that requires modifications of the plant, then, correct? Yeah, and it, you know, there's lots of ways you can use bin login, Zoom challenge response for straight user login, so that'll break things like FTP. The NSH 2.0 protocol does take into account things like challenge response and the fact that people use things like X9.9 token-based solutions or SP or OP or whatever. And that will do, I think, a lot to improve the authentication mechanism.
Okay, somebody else had a gratuitous plug out there for a TIFF. The officer hooks. Okay, I'm not familiar with those. This comes back to the Fisher Cup 8 thing. How many years did it take to get a deployed and widely used encrypted telnet, if you will? 20? This wasn't the first one out there. I think SSH did a great job because it was the first one that was readily transparent to the end user and easy to use. And you notice that since it was so easy to use, it's deployed and people are using it. So, you know, kudos to them for getting something out there.
Gail has a comment on that,
too. Yeah, I think one of the problems with the current implementation of SSH is that you run into the large complicated system problems. There are many things involved. And one thing that I've seen lately is a lot of admins saying, oh my god, it's encrypted, let's use it for tunneling, woo! And I've seen it in a lot of places. They use it for X11 over intercompany VPNs, and when you have people that don't know what they're doing trying to use SSH as a security mechanism right now, it's actually, when you have people who don't know what they're doing trying to use anything, you're going to run into problems, and I think that's an area that's going to see some things soon.
It brings up the band-aid theory. Administrators think if they employ like SSH, the network is secure. Administrators think if they employ a firewall, the network is secure. And is, I don't want to go into detail, but someone over here has something to say.
Well, what he said, SSH, the vast majority of people are using SSH with their regular passwords. So it's certainly possible to sit there and hammer passwords through the encrypted pipe just as it is over a plain text login. Last week I looked into this a little bit, and I was pointing it out before during Shipley's thing. You can sit there and under the default configuration of logging, you can try up to 5 times for a user login, and if you disconnect instead of try again and then reconnect and then just keep doing these sets of 5 from a dictionary, it'll never log. So you really need to turn on the anal logging in the config file if you want to see any of this happen.
You right there? Do you agree that global management tools add an extra layer of security to the network?
A particular company came up to me at one point with a global network management type thing that ostensibly also does security and auditing and logging, and I asked them the one question, which was, you have all these end nodes reporting to this main central collection mechanism about security problems on all of the machines. How are you moving the traffic back and forth? And they said, well, it's encrypted. I said, that's great. How is it encrypted? You go, DES or something? Like, that's great. DES is symmetrical encryption. How are you exchanging the keys for this? Oh, I don't know. We'll get an engineer back to you on that. I looked into it, and it took a little while, but they were XORing the traffic and sending it. So I well, yeah, that's sort of like DES. DES has an XOR in it. Which one was what? I'm not gonna mention the company actually, because this was in a day job type thing. But what happened? So I go back to him and I said, you know, you're XORing your traffic. You know, this is not DES. Oh, DES is planned for the next release. Okay, great. Here comes the next release or whatever.
None of these guys writing these global network management stuff understand security. Otherwise, they wouldn't be doing global network management stuff and trying to put security into it. So I don't like them. I don't like the notion of single sign-on either. It's the chicken and the egg. It's the scalability problem. I think there are probably good ideas for user management and for things like that, but I don't think security is any of these companies' forte.
Chris? Has anyone looked at Lucent's firewall? It's stateful. That's what you want to see. It's bad. Okay, anyone else? In the back? Yep. What would you recommend as an alternative to secure IP or one-time?
There is the X9.9 standard, which is basically one-time DES-based password scheme, where basically you have shared keys between the server and the client, or server and the card, and the server can generate a response, can generate a challenge, and using the touchpad on the card, you're able to generate the proper response. It's a one-time system also. It's DES-based, it's public. You can go to ANSI.org, get the standard, get the spec, read it, and decide for yourself if you agree with it and trust it or not.
Yeah, these things are called DES calculators in the trade a lot. If getting out of the entire geez, you might still be doing plain text, it doesn't necessarily solve hijacking or anything else like that. If you're looking for just direct alternatives to Security Dynamics cards, I have several recommendations. First off, Security Dynamics is not a real challenge response system. It's not a challenge response. It's a time-based thing. They're trying to keep track of the card. I like challenge response systems over that any day. Death Gold, CryptoCard by CryptoCard Inc. All of these guys are just challenge response tokens. The server will give you a number. You type it in. You generate your DES key or whatever, or your DES calculator response, send it back and let you in. I don't know why Security Dynamics hasn't offered a challenge response token itself. I have a soft spot in my heart for CryptoCard Incorporated. Because they actually showed that they were really open and willing to work. They have the notion where you can have three separate keys, three separate DES keys. So you can be connected to three separate CryptoCard server machines, if you will. And somebody approached them and said, we've got three spots here, and what happens if we only have one server? Would you let us please do triple DES? It's trivial, they can encrypt, decrypt, encrypt. And they said, sure. And so they turned around within like a week, instantly you had, triple DES card. So I thought that was a really right attitude to do it. And those are some of the other alternatives. The X.99 is a good spec to go to.
As you start to move to more RPC-based things, you got DCD, the app deployment, and become more of it. But like without what clients and other things that people are going to be out on the road with, how do you see making a good RPC-based solution to get into your enterprise? And how would you go about doing that?
RPC-based solutions for remote users.
Anyone? Hobbit? Well, I know Dan knew nothing about Corba or any of that object stuff. It seems that implementations of RPC in general, be it DCE or Sun style, has authentication hooks built into the protocol, but nobody ever seems to use them. It always comes back down to the plain text or UID, GID kind of fixed
fixed string authenticators. And apparently it's just hard to get the authenticated stuff up and running correctly and deploy it to users so it's transparent to them. There's a lot more work needs to happen there.
I think we've gone over our time, so we're going to wrap it up. Like two more questions. This guy right here.
The question is, with the newer TCP ISN generators that use a pseudo-random number generator instead of just incrementing the initial sequence number that it's going to use in a connection, has anybody tried to exploit that? I don't know, personally. It's an interesting... Ledge mentioned Ian Goldberg would be a good person to poke about that. Yeah, or Theo. Okay, I'm going to wrap it up. Does anyone have any website they would recommend or tools that they would recommend? Which guy? You?
I'm not going to get any specifics, but in most cases, the network management companies and implementers are going for network management and convenience, and security is always the second thought. You know, I've done extensive work with a lot of the big vendor SNMP daemons and managers, and I've found in almost every single instance there's some stupid mistake or some stupid default or whatnot that's been left. Why, I don't know. But again, you know, security is really a second thought in this case, and you know, people want to be able to throw a machine on the network and be able to access it immediately, and until people can take the time or are willing to take the time to secure these machines, they're going to be insecure.
Yeah, security is really, it's become a buzzword. People have their nifty little network management tool, they say, and let's make it secure, and they just go ahead and you know, throw something in there, and I think there are many problems with that, and I think if people take a closer look at that, they'll find them. So, there you go.
Okay, resources, www.openbsd.org. www.nsa. Okay. Anyone else?
CPIO Networks is coming out with a couple papers in the very near future, and their website is www.cpio.net. I don't recall what the exact URL for the paper section is, but if you look, it's very conspicuously linked from the first page, so you'll find it. I don't recall what they're coming out with next, but. Check them on Monday or Tuesday, and there should be some interesting stuff.
Jericho has a pretty cool mailing list that you guys should check out. You want
to? Information Security News. Subscribe through MajorDemo and security.org. And it's real high-level articles about the security industry, what's happening, new products sometimes, big bugs, vulnerabilities. Check it out. It's pretty low traffic, too.
Security with a K. And of course, you know www.frag.com, is it? The law, www.l0phc.com. SecNet, www.secnet.com.
www.repsec.com as well.
Anyone else?
www.jennycamp.com.
.org.
Anyone else? Okay, I guess that wraps it up. Great example is the horrible macrovision crap, which makes your videos look like shit. It would be illegal to build a frame buffer or a sync enhancer into a VCR or video capture card because it would defeat that copyright protection scheme. In the software world, let's say you have a Newton that has a 4-bit display. It would be illegal to write a program to reduce the bit depth of images to optimize useful data, since so doing would eliminate Digimar copyright clips. Again, it's not the act, it's the technology. 1202 protects copyright management information, and this is a double screw for your data optimizers and sync restorers, because even making an analog copy of a digital work, it's illegal to alter or remove the copyright information, which may be contained in the digital signal itself, and may not be reproducible in an analog format. Now, it could just be written on a CD, on the text, but if it doesn't go with the copy, even if the copy is fair use, the copier is a violator. And penalties are no joke. 1202 is generally cited as another protection for cookies as well, despite the direct and limited exceptions we mentioned earlier. It basically makes it illegal to tamper with or delete or edit cookies, password files, or even press files, even if you know they're corrupted. Again, it's not where you're actually infringed, it's what you do that's illegal. If your press file has your serial number or name in it, and the copyright control process, even if the developer wouldn't care if you delete and start over, even if doing so is fair use under existing doctrine, under 1202 it's a crime. You can't delete corrupted press files, technically. The It's interesting to note that the exceptions to 1202 and 1237 in the latest version, broadcasters, that is commercially FCC-approved broadcasters, and this is a narrow exemption that they obviously wrote themselves, don't need to broadcast the copyright information, but everybody else does. The law says only FCC-approved radio and television broadcasters are exempt from broadcasting copyright information. If you have a pirate radio station, you're not only busted by the FCC, but also by the data police, since you do not have an exemption to keeping the copyright information intact of the broadcast, performance, or other ephemeral copy. Both bills in F and D, which if you're following along on your own copy of the bill, 1201F, 1201D, law enforcement is granted sweeping powers, especially in the Senate bill, where basically every government contractor, not just law enforcement official, but every contractor is given a blanket exemption. So none of this applies to the various NARCs here in the normal course of your duties. Which is actually interesting, as you see in the next talk, we'll talk about how, in the next section, we'll talk about a provision which allows invasion of personal privacy and how the exemptions to Copyright Act are useful to law enforcement, which is, both bills provide some measure of exemption of liability for ISPs, which is in Section 512. Basically, it sets forth the terms of a large commercial ISP would like to protect them from the violations of their users. Guess who probably wrote it? Think AOL? Yeah, good guess. Since they're predicated on a reasonable presumption of ignorance, they might not be applicable to smaller ISPs, who presumably would know more about the activities of the people on their system. The provisions of the bill in plain English provide an exemption for an ISP, for a service provider, who acts in good faith, who is not required to search the contents of their users' files proactively, although they must respond on notice, and I'll get to that, but they're not required to search the contents of their files proactively, and on the basis of reasonable ignorance, are not held liable for copyright violations. That's great for AOL, but it doesn't do anything for a small ISP. If you're giving an account to somebody and you know them personally, it may not be reasonable, it depends on a court to find, whether you would be criminally responsible for their copyright violations. What's interesting to note about these provisions is access is specifically granted to the ISP to violate the user's right to privacy on suspicion or report of a copyright violation. Under 512G, a copyright owner need only provide your ISP with a sworn statement that he or she thinks you're violating their copyright. This isn't a court order, this is a sworn statement, it's not hard to get. And the ISP is required within 14 days to investigate the contents of your account and is not required to tell you that it's done so. It's an obvious and striking extension of civil search and seizure and grants rights copyright holders in the electronic world that is without precedent in the physical world. And by the way, you have no redress. Let's say you're a flame war with some reporter and winning. He could quite easily obtain the full contents of your account on the premise that he thinks you're storing copies of his data and that's how you're quoting him or whatever on your disk beyond your fair use and that you've downloaded from the New York Times website or something. You can then get the entire contents of your account. And your ISP is not required to tell you that it's done that. That's pretty much the major points of the legal law and where copyright stands now, but it's far from clear that copyright law has a leg to stand on. First, the fuss we're seeing about enhancing copyright is predicated on the assumption that we're entering an information-based economy and that we're passing ever more draconian laws in an attempt to build a foundation for that economy without considering whether IP is a valid concept. First, IP law is not immune to challenge. It's an odd concept to begin with. What do you own when you own an idea? A thought? If you share with me that thought, is it not in my head also? Do you therefore own something that most probably has a physical manifestation in my brain? If memory turns out to be encoded in proteins, do you own those proteins? IP law has no clear foundation for its justification, and its history has been justified in various ways. The first one was natural law. Under natural law, those naturally occurring things with which I mix my labor are granted ownership to me. I can do that. Premise that two cannot simultaneously have possession of the applied to one or the other. Hello? Yeah. This is not the case with IP. Is Jefferson... Hello?
Okay.
Yeah.
This is not the case with IP. As Jefferson so eloquently pointed out, IP is not scarce. My use does not conflict with your use. And so exclusive ownership need not be established. Another is fairness. Another justification for copyright law is that it's only fair. If I invent it, I have a right to profit from it. Fine. Except that I can patent my mousetrap, but not a mathematical algorithm.
Or philosophical truth. This is fun. Obviously, allowing protection of these would create problems. You couldn't live an existential life without paying the estate of Camus, for example. But if creations of philosophy aren't deserving of remuneration, can we fairness as a justification for IP law if we have refused to apply the law fairly? The Constitution endorses the utility theory that IP law is necessary to promote the useful arts. The premise of this is that the creators would not create if they weren't paid. This crowd, more than most, dismisses that idea on its face. Just look at Linux, Sendmill, FreeBSD, or a number of incredibly useful programs and technologies that have been created, many best in their class without any remuneration. It is clear that the profiteers of copyright law, the newly protected class of sellers and distributors who now have an equal stake in IP that paves their way, are dependent on copyright law. And in the past, an argument could have been made that the availability of IP is dependent on those publishers making a profit from it, independent of paying the authors, or rather their expensive distribution methods would fail. But this is no longer true. Is it now reasonable to consider publication to be cost-free? In fact, the very successful distribution schemes of things like Linux show that not only can superior products be developed without remuneration, but they can also be widely distributed. If it is the optimization of the greatest good we seek, it is clear that the path that WIPO and other bills take is not going to be successful. It is obvious that these laws are being passed for the benefit of the corporations that profit from the distribution and control of ideas and information. And this is an unconscionable perversion of the original and noble intent of copyright law and represents a tremendous shift. In effect, the government is becoming the willing agent of corporations against its population. Your tax money goes to support the profitability of corporations in violation of your right to information. But can it succeed? This is the real question. I posit that the punishments created for violating copyright law, for fringing on corporate profitability, which exceed the penalties for murder in some cases, that these laws are a de facto recognition of the fact that most of the population doesn't give a damn about copyright law. Unlike tangible property law, which benefits everyone directly and carries the new unto others reciprocity that everyone can understand the population does not own IP. And so these laws only hinder them and do not benefit them. And so why should they only pay attention?
In the article that I have on Wednesday, there are 20th of April, called Copyleft, I attempt to describe the situation for and the very proposals that they're not hearing. One of the proposals is actually years ago, Eric Hughes, he called it the universal piracy system. And it's also basically the second was by a person named David Rogers at university. And his proposal was that we should have libraries that are essentially free access to copyright material by anyone, and that the copyright people, the department of our owners, would be reimbursed for the frequency of access to their work. And the total amount of money that's spent in the economy for compensating the copyright owners would be divided up between the taxes and the benefits. And the proposal that I gave is that copyright should be treated just like trademark. Very short amount of time, and are no longer available. replace it, it's permanently out of print, so that a certain feature of copyright law can be used called reversion rights, which are common in publisher. I'm not sure. Therefore, a work that goes out of print will not be available again, and the owner of that copyright feature, the author, will not be able to use his work again because the publisher's extension for closing. So what I propose is that after 2 years, that the work is not working on a publication, it's no longer available, and it is no longer serving a useful purpose that copyright was originally intended to, which is to provide something useful to society. If I can't go out to a book seller and purchase an independently copyrighted work, then why should anyone have any future benefit if I'm being denied the purpose? So that was my proposal. But to get more broadly, all of these laws that are being proposed are very much the same ones that happened in the late 1800s. The church, which controlled all of the Russian property in Western Europe, saw a tremendous threat, and they tried to foreclose on the ability for anyone to write a print on the or a president on the deal. That's the Gutenberg who was sitting there as one. So it's not a well as well known thing that the person who can't even maneuver why the deputy for his deed. But not before the distribution of the document. And I believe that there is no simple way that people can support the others that find these laws objections were going to be able to turn the tide by working within the system. I don't think it's going to happen because there's too much money on the table. The only way this is going to happen is the general public ignores the law or the direct action against the people in the government on an individual basis to prevent it. It's criminal, so what? The laws are criminal. If you make criminals out of the general population, then if this be treated as most of them, okay, this is what's going on with the new society, because the people control the emotion part of the great part of the they don't get pushed out any law that is in line with any action that we know we're all criminals, that we're not safe, and then when we die in our field, have somehow stepped on somebody's criminal. And so instead of trying to hide from it, what we need to do is find a way to tell our sources and try to keep it to the people that are beyond the state. Something that this is just not one of the non study schools. Jim Bell was an expert at Hudson is now serving in jail. But the point is that there needs to be a counterbalancing force that is not within the Republican or Democratic process, which is subverted, but outside that process, where individuals can make their will known directly to the individual who they claim that they're doing.
That brings up an interesting point because that exact process was anticipated in the legal copyright law, which has a paragraph which says that in 6 months they want to review the effectiveness of the already pre-commission fund, the already $500,000 fine by the first offense, 10 years in prison, $1 million fine by a second offense. They're going to review and see if they've been effective in controlling copyright law. If they haven't, just to make them more strict.
Yes. I don't have a large budget, and if you make a sale, my work happens to be out there available. After 6 months, I'm in the attic and then turn around and start selling it.
Okay,
but I'm not able to sell it.
But I'm saying, if I can't present my money to you, purchase another one. Because you're saying you don't want to bother me, I'm saying, therefore, you're not entitled to your copyright protection on your work. Because as far as we can see, of copyright protection, it's a usefulness to society. If I can't buy it, and you won't sell it, it'd be too much to buy it.
Right, well, my point is, there are certain aspects of visa that I don't like, it's very much but going the whole idea of copyright out and trying to attack it, I don't think it's quite right, because if you can't find me, if you can't find me to buy it, that's no different than you saying, well, I can't get it.
No, I think that's a different idea. I think it's more copyright work. Whoever it is, in a business, can't make the work available. If not now, pray it will be any good they will go to the authorized agent. I think that's the deal. I really think it would be better how we want to operate.
How about you?
Thank you.
that we take action against individual lawmakers, that you can be in front of the government. The thing that we should do is we should basically get rid of our numbers to stay in office and let other people anonymously take action against those people, or to allow them to take money that they spent and leave office. I'm saying that, I mean, I don't believe that the person can be used in a fashion of control of corporations and money to be grabbed from those corporations and lobbyists. And the democratic process that we have is not functioning as the traditional intent for the who's in charge. I'm not scared of the political action.
Two more questions, and we have another speaker. So what you're basically saying is that you want to make captive lawmakers the first one to act against civil engineering. You want to make these bets and everything. Just want to separate yourself from the idea.
Exactly. One by one, it's like a democratic process. It's only like thousands where people speak for their money, just like you go to Washington. But you don't have to go to Washington to speak.
Well, it's really useful action would be for some of the peers who will be going to jail for the you get busted for talking to people, something really obvious, and go to jail with something public. I mean, I'll do all the fundraising for your we have one more question, all right?
I think as far as the law has come so far, and where they are at this point, people in the House of the little we can do at this point to stop it. So I'm just trying to say, it's gone a long way. It's been 2 years in making. There's a lot of time and possibility for people to make a cut during the 2 years in development. But at this point, I don't see anything we can do at this point. Not this one. But I think there are a lot of challenges possible if they try to enforce things like you can't pay the code of behavior. Are there things that are very, there's loopholes that very easy to challenge, legally speaking. You can have the money, you can get charged at the time, hire attorneys for representing legal people. I know, that's what I'm saying. There are a number of ways to keep it from actually being enforced the way that you were worried about. I mean, there are constitutional protections and things like that. But that's, at this point, I think, the only way to do
it. And I think it's something that will happen in the future. I mean, seasonally, it's important. I think to respond more than the outcome. And a number of outrages that happened as there was from the CIA. And in fact, some of the same players were quite fairly effective. That did help to get the environment better. Because if you see it, it's not very good. Thanks very much. That's all we'll take for now. I'm going to try to out of
out of these. We can walk up to someone selling things, we can hand them a piece of paper or the metal object, and they'll give us something in return. And to be honest, I'm pretty standardized at scale. How many people are going to be able to get back? We're moving more and more into the digital world where it's kind of hard to pay for certain things, you know, the piece of paper or the piece of metal. And it would be advantageous for us to use a little bit more electronic, faster methods. So, obviously, digital world, digital cash. Digital cash has a lot of similarities to the stuff you find in your pocket. Capital automation, different collateral, product cases that act like something. Now, however, some of the differences is that it will actually allow you to speed up transactions in certain places, make it easier to find certain things. People with work art can sell to a greater audience because they've got a faster, more automated way of selling it, and it's a hard work on the list. Thank you.
your history of how much they contract. Thank you.
$100 into the graduate program, but it set up the